Accession number 34702.
Reel 2.
Hey, Denham, reel 2. So, what was the next stage for you after Scarborough?
They had a system then of where you went and did 12 hours flying in tiger moths at which they called the grading school to assess your ability and whether you would go forward for further training as a pilot. So I went to Brough near Hull, did my 12 hours on the tiger moth, and from there went back to a holding unit, which was in Manchester, ACDC Manchester. Eaton Park was taken over by the RAF.
For a second, Eric, if that's all right. But can I ask you about the grading school?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the grading school at Brough, what you actually did when you were there?
Yeah, well, there's a log sheet somewhere. That was it there.
So when you started out, what's the first thing that they do when they introduce you to a tiger moth? What was the sort of first kind of familiarisation thing that you have to do in it?
Well, it's just sort of shown around the aircraft, shown the various part of the ailerons, elevators and all this sort of thing. I mean, we had been taught the theory of, or principles of flight before, so we knew about these things and the shown how they worked and all the rest of it. And then you went up with an instructor and did straight and level and turned, and then he would hand over to you to do the same. And sort of went on from there, and then started doing landings and takeoffs and practicing them. And if at the end the weather was right and you'd done very well, you'd perhaps go solo, but I didn't in my case. It wasn't necessary. You were judged on your abilities regardless of whether you'd gone solo or not, because of the weather may have been a factor, which...
So, in an aircraft like a tiger moth, again, with aircraft, they've changed so much.
Mm.
How do you achieve the movements in it? What's the sort of setup?
Well, it's pretty basic. You've got a rudder, which you put your feet on, to skid it left or right. You've got a control column. Forward would put your nose down, pulling back would pull your nose up, putting over to the left. Will drop your left wing, raise your right wing, cause you to turn to the left, and vice versa, and so on. You would also learn how not to stall the aircraft, because if you come in to land and stall it, you just fall out of the sky and break it. So you used to do practicing stalling and recovering from the stall, that sort of thing.
Did you get put into a spin in it at all?
Hand spins, yes. Spins. Left and right hand spins, recovery from, yes.
How do you recover from a spin?
Well, you virtually pull the stick forward, straighten up the aeroplane. You've got to take all the power off, of course, and then gradually pull it out. Once it straightens, ease it out of the dive.
Because I'm assuming to non-flyers or people who've not had a regular amount of time in aircraft, that seems perhaps the most terrifying of...
Yes, I suppose. I don't think it's anything they do these days with big aeroplanes. We didn't used to do it with the larger aeroplanes now. The stalling, yes, but not the spinning. But spinning was quite well used in the training, I think, in the initial training in those days, certainly on the training aircraft.
And with a tiger moth, I take it you had to learn to take it off, did you?
Oh, yes, yes.
How do you achieve takeoff in a little biplane like that?
Well, it's quite easy, really. You just line it up and put the power on, use the rudders to keep it straight till you reach your unstick speed, which... and then ease the stick back and let it climb away.
And landing again, right, because with something like that, how much is there an element of judgment in your landing?
Well, yes, you have to judge the power on the approach to keep within your approach speed, and use your judgment, of course, to level out at the right height above the ground, and when to take the power off, and the aircraft will sink slowly onto the ground, we hope, not fall onto it.
And do you have to have a sort of judgment about
keeping
where the ground is?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. You need to be looking out all the time, yes, and just glancing down at the instruments to check your speed.
And with the Tiger Moth, I imagine that the instruments are relatively primitive, are they, with
yes,
that you have?
Yes, yes. You had an altimeter for height, an airspeed indicator, a rate of climb and descent indicator, a turn indicator, and that was about it. That's what they call the primary flight panel, as it were, yes.
And when you were, I mean, I take it, again, you went up with an instructor for most of the course, did you?
For the grading school course.
How do you communicate with your instructor in the aircraft?
Well, you had a thing which is stuck in your ears, and a pipe, and he had the same, and that was it. There was no electronic communication. It was purely through a pipe.
So what the kind of... They've got you to be able to fly the aircraft, have they, at the grading school. Is it just so you know how to handle it? I'm assuming then that with it, that it's about
it's,
just checking people's competencies or if they turn to it?
It's about whether... They don't want people to go on to flying training and then fail much later on, where it's cost them a lot of money and taken up a lot of training space. So they want to try and assess at an early stage whether that student will make a pilot or not, and weed them out at an early stage if they're completely useless, in other words, at that point, which they reckon they could do in that 12 hours.
I'm assuming some people can't get the
yeah.
coordination, or they're not
that's
happy
right,
about
yes.
actually in the air, are
oh,
they?
Yes, that's true, yes.
What was the next stage for you then after you'd done the grading school? Where did you go to next?
Well, as I said, I went to Manchester, Eaton Park. And then it was just a matter of waiting then to see where the next posting was to commence further training.
How long were you there?
I was there for 2 months. You see all this accumulation of time it takes to get from A to B at this training scheme.
And how did you fill your time then?
They tried to make us, you know, do everything all over again. Morse code training, more navigation, more drill, more anything to keep us occupied. Which was, as you can imagine, keeping a few thousand young, bright airmen cooped up in Eaton Park. Well, they didn't want to be there. They wanted to get on with their training. So most of the time they were trying to break out of camp anyway, which they succeeded in quite often. And the fact that it seemed to be raining all the time as well didn't help. So...
What facilities did you actually have in Eaton Park, though? Was it...
Nothing much, really. We lived in Nissen huts, and we had a mess hall. That was another thing. We had to do duties in there, peeling spuds and doing all those sort of things, which you do in the services. So the time just went by, and that was it. 2 months was a long time.
I take it you were glad when you got orders for your posting, were you?
Well, what would just happen, every morning we would parade outside the bandstand, and they would read out names of everybody who was posted and where they were going to, and then the rest were dismissed and off he went back again. And I say it took 2 months, and then I was posted, I was told I was posted to America to go training on the BFTS scheme in America, which initially meant we were going to Canada first before we went down there.
So how did you get to Canada then?
So we were taken up to overnight to Gourock in Glasgow and boarded the RMT Andes, which had been a cruise ship, I think, on the South American run before the war. We were shown where we were going to sleep and how to put our hammocks up, which was a bit alien to us, of course. And off we went. As you can imagine, there was nowhere to stow anything away, so you got in the hammock in your clothing, really. And once again, it wasn't all that pleasant. People had been sick and all the rest of it, and it was pretty horrific. But anyway, we survived it, and I think we, as long as you had your knife, fork and spoon, you could eat. Had the usual meals, which were quite reasonable, I think, after wartime food. And we went into Halifax.
Can I ask what it was like sleeping in a hammock?
Terrible. Might be all right if you're used to it as a sailor, but as a landlubber, no, I didn't enjoy it a little bit. One little bit, no.
Did you have to do any sort of duties on board at all? Or was it...
Yes. Some were allocated to man the guns in case of any attack by aircraft. And as far as I remember, they weren't in convoy, I don't think. I think we were zigzagged across during the day, and then they went flat out at night, straight ahead, and hope for the best. And of course, we were had to do boat drills and lifeboat drills and that sort of thing, for obvious reasons. And the rest of the time, well, you just filled in as best you could. There was no real facilities. I mean, you could play cards, of course. Card schools sprang up all over the place.
How long did it take to get across?
I don't know if I... about 3 days, I think it was, something like that.
So it was quite a fast passage that you had, was it, then?
Yeah, 3 or 4 days, something like that, I think, yes. Yes.
And what happened when you got to Halifax?
Well, we were put on the train then. This was Christmas Day, I think, 1942. Two. Yes. To go down to Moncton in New Brunswick, which was the holding area. It was pretty cold, of course, in December. And I remember we had an incident. There was an incident that somebody had got on the track and the train ran into it, and we were held up for several hours in the cold waiting for this thing to be cleared before we got down to Moncton. Anyway, we got to Moncton eventually and were taken to this big hangar place and given something to eat and something to drink and then allocated to accommodation. And must have been there for about nearly 3 weeks, I suppose, before we went down to to Florida.
Again, how did you pass that time?
I don't remember, really. I think we had to do things like guard duties, nighttime guard duties as well, and daytime. And again, once again, the inevitable Morse code and all these sort of things. But of course, being very cold, they couldn't do a lot of outdoor activity anyway. And we were briefed on, you know, always keeping our ears covered up and all this sort of thing, especially if we're doing guard duty. And we were issued with our American tropical uniform, trousers and shirts, ready for going down to Florida. And that was it. And eventually they put us on a train in Moncton. 3 days later we arrived in Florida, I think it was. We kept the same carriages all the way down. They weren't sleeping carriages. The British government wouldn't pay for sleeping compartments. And these carriages, we went to stop to places like Boston and New York, and then they were hitched onto other trains, and sometimes we had several hours off. And we were still in blue uniforms, winter uniforms as well. And because as we got further and further south, it was getting hotter and hotter, and these carriages were beginning to get a bit rank as well. people trying to sleep in them, you know, and it was a bit chaotic, really. We had meals in the dining cars that they were laid on, and sometimes when we stopped at Boston and New York and somewhere else, somebody would meet us and take us off the train, and we'd go off and have a meal somewhere else for a change, until we went back to the train and found we were hitched up to another train, and then off we'd go again. So I think it took us 3 days to get down.
What impressions did you get of the United States? Because obviously you've come from Britain and under blackout and rationing. Was the
that was the main thing, of course, the absence of rationing. You can have as many eggs as you want for breakfast and all this sort of thing, which we hadn't had in this country. And meat, of course, you could have a big steak if you wanted, if you could pay for it. Not that we were very well paid, but we had, at that time, been promoted from Air Craftsman Class 2, the lowest form of life in the Royal Air Force, up to leading Air Craftsman. And our pay had been increased from 2 shillings a day to 7 and 6 pence a day, which was quite luxurious, really, 7 and 6. And we could spend that, you know, change it into dollars and spend that, so if you wanted to, on the way down, in the shops and in the bars, that sort of thing. And that was about it. I think we stopped finally, just before Clewiston, we stopped at a place called Sebring. And there was a welcoming party of locals there from the USO, who brought us things to eat and all the rest of it, and introduced themselves and exchanged names and addresses and said, come and see us when you got time off, that sort of thing. And then we went on to Clewiston, which is where we're in the final destination, number 5 BFTS.
And what was the organisation like at Clewiston for you?
That was okay, fine. This was run by Riddle McKay Aero College, an American organisation which ran the school. The only RAF permanent staff there were as a wing commander, the adjutant, and 2 or 3 armament NCOs. The rest were all American civilians, the flying instructors and the ground instructors. But we were taught RAF ground instruction, not American. They'd been taught the same sort of thing to pass on to us.
An accommodation there?
Accommodation was very good, yes. I think we had four to a room, and then there was a bathroom in between, and then four into the next room. So that was quite good, yes.
So how did your flying training start then?
Well, we trained initially on the Stearman PT-17. That was their initial trainer. It was similar to a Tiger Moth, but bigger and a bit more powerful. So we started off again as from scratch, you know, introduction to the aircraft and air experience, and then we went on to effects of control, straight and level flight, climbing and descending, taxiing, medium level turns.
With that, then, the introduction to the aircraft and air experience, is that essentially just a familiarisation for
yes,
flight, is it?
That's right. You go up with the instructor and it shows you around the aircraft, all the rest of it, and then get in and take off and fly, and then it shows you the effect of the controls. In other words, they assumed you hadn't any flying experience at all, and we started off with the effect of ailerons and elevators and all the rest of it, and rudders. And that was it on the first trip, I suppose.
Is it a familiarisation flight with the local area as well,
yes,
though?
Yes. Oh, yes. Of the airfield, yes. Yeah. It was a grass airfield, yes.
So when he takes you up on that familiarisation flight, does he demonstrate something and then allow you to have a go?
No. Yes. Straight and level flight, for instance, which seems fairly simple. It wasn't all that simple initially, of course, because you had to keep it straight and level. There's nothing to hold it in that position. You have to look at the horizon. That, you know, people were taught these things. Look at the horizon, put your nose on the horizon, hold it there and hold the wings level. You know, those sort of things, yeah. The simple things, which you took for granted later on, yeah.
But I take it at first it's just getting used to handling the aircraft.
That's right,
it?
yes.
So he will take you around on that first flight. Do you then progress with a sort of sequence of instruction as
yes,
to what you need to do?
Yes, you start going on to turns, medium level turns, ordinary, and then steep turns and things like that, stalling and spinning. All the other things that come into it.
So with an aircraft like the Stearman, how do you achieve a turn with that?
All aircraft are on the same principle, yes. You put on the bank and feed in a bit of rudder, and then the wing will go down, the other wing will go up, and the aircraft will turn. Ease back on the stick to keep the nose up, otherwise the nose will drop down. Little things like that.
And with steeper turns, is there
even more back pressure and a bit more power to hold it in the turn, that sort of thing.
So is it the case then that they're trying to get you to get the feel of that aircraft, how to do those sort
yes,
of basic manoeuvres?
Yes, these are the basic manoeuvres we're going to apply to whatever aircraft you fly, whatever system controls in operation.
And you mentioned as well, obviously, they do a sequence of instruction as though you've never flown before, although you've done 12 hours
yes,
of grading school.
Yes, that's right, yes. You start from scratch again, yes.
Was it a good sensation actually to finally get into an aircraft though and start training? Because you've been in quite a bottleneck for the last year or so.
Well, yes, and it continues. It continues. Yes, it was. At least we were doing something and we were getting on with it. And we knew we had 6 months then of concentrated training.
Do they get you to stall the aircraft in that training?
Later on, yes. You didn't do that initially. That was sort of, initially it was all straight and level flight and turning and taking off and landing and that sort of thing.
So very sort of gentle manoeuvres, is it?
Then after the first week or two, we're on to stalling quite quickly.
You mentioned on there, though, before that, Eric, you'd done taxiing. Was there a specific way of taxiing a steerman?
No. It was straightforward enough. You just put the power on and release the brakes and away you went.
And was visibility okay for that sort of thing?
It was, yes. Not so later on when you got under things like Spitfires. There wasn't any visibility then. You had to weave, yes.
So they got you onto stalling quite quickly, did they?
Yes, as far as I can see here, after the first few trips, we were already onto stalling here and spinning in the first couple of weeks, yeah. Forced landings.
What did that involve then? Landing training.
That was the idea. Where there was that if you had an engine failure, you had to get down somewhere. So you would simulate that by just throttling back the engine and picking a field somewhere that looked as though it was suitable for landing, no trees or boulders or anything like that, and go in and wouldn't actually land necessarily. You'd overshoot, but if the engine had failed, you would have landed there, of course.